Welcome to the Dividend Talk Podcast, episode 101, Dividend Growth Investing with Thiago Diaz. Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of Dividend Talk. Today I'm joined with Thiago Diaz, who's going to talk about his journey into dividend growth investing. See you on the inside. Hey Thiago, welcome to Dividend Talk and thank you so much for coming on to the show today.
Glad to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
It's a rare occasion that European DGI gets a week off, but he's on vacation at the moment. So we thought we'd give him an extended break and bring you on maybe to discuss a little bit about your journey. I can't believe we haven't had you on already. You've been part of this community since probably day one. So quite interested to chat to you and for our listeners to hear you. For some people that may not know, maybe you might just introduce who you are just a little bit.
Yeah, sure. So my name is Thiago Dias. I am a Portuguese investor. I began investing quite a while ago. And last year in, I believe, February, I started working on a weekly blog where I discuss my philosophy about investing, certain key data points that I think are important for investors to look into when they're evaluating a company. And of course, every few weeks, I look deeply, well, as deeply as a retail investor can go into a specific business, either a business that I already own or one that I am considering purchasing, or just one that has been in the news a lot recently. And yeah, that's most of what I do. And that's about it, I guess.
Awesome. Yeah, it's quite an interesting story. You say you're investing for quite a long time and you're still quite young, so I'm quite interested. Do you remember how you got into dividend growth investing? Can you tell us a little bit about that? How did you fall apart?
So there's a difference between getting into dividend growth investing and getting into investing in the first place. I would say that the first time that I really started looking into investing was, I believe, 2011 or so. I had just entered university. I'd just become an adult. And at the time, my parents were great. And while I was growing up, they set up a small bank account for me. And every few months, they deposited a little bit of money. It wasn't a lot of money, less than 1,500 euros, realistically speaking. But when I turned 18, I got control of that account and I suddenly had 1,400 euros in the bank, just getting eaten up by bank fees all the time. And so, of course, I didn't want that. So I moved banks and the new bank that I went to had an investment platform. And at the time, I had already considered investing as a career. So throughout my middle school and high school, I had looked into being a trader. And at the time, I was doing a bachelor's degree in information management, which had a lot of statistics, a lot of math-heavy data science related classes, and I wanted to see if I could apply any of that to investing. And so with the new bank, with the trading platform, I decided, okay, this is the time. I knew enough to know I didn't know what I was doing. So I thought my best option here is, let's go with an index fund, something that will be diversified and will provide me decent returns. And let me tell you, that was a terrible idea.
Why was that?
So first of all, I didn't have a lot of money, like you can tell. And I didn't want to put all of my money in at once in a single basket.
Yeah.
So I picked one fund and I purchased one share in that fund. I can't even remember what the fund was. But the one share was like 250 euros or something like that. And I thought, okay, now I just need to wait a bit, carry it on. First problem, I didn't take a look at the fees the bank was charging.
Of course, yes.
And that's something that nowadays I really look into. But I had 250 euros invested. And for my first purchase, it cost me 6 euros. And in addition to that, there was a quarterly fee just to hold the funds into my account. And that was another 12 euros.
A quarter?
Yes. So I let the first quarter go by, and then I look into it, and I see that my 250 euro investment has gotten totally eaten up by fees. And then I'm like, okay, this is not for me. Clearly, I should have looked into this a little bit better. I sold everything, didn't get charged any more fees, and decided, okay, let's wait a few years. And so I waited a few years. Eventually, that was my first experience with investing. And I'm pretty sure a lot of investors, particularly here in Europe, are going to have a similar experience where they try to put in a little bit and unfortunately the fees eat up whatever gains they might have possibly gained.
It's quite an important lesson, isn't it, for especially new investors, because it's quite easy. I mean, you read a lot and of course you're told to invest in index funds, but you very rarely hear people talk about fees, especially quarterly fees, eating into your returns like that. So quite straight off the bat, it was quite a good lesson, I think, to learn, because I don't think you'll make that mistake ever again.
That's right. So those were the most effective 18 euros that I have ever paid in terms of my investor mindset.
Which is pretty cheap, actually, if you look at the grand scheme of things. Yeah. So I mean, you were young, started investing, and you get hit with fees. You take a break.
Yeah.
So then how do you get back into it then? What's the turning point here?
So eventually I finished university. I started working. I started having some regular savings. And in 2017, I eventually moved to Germany to work. And at that time, I made significantly more money than I had any use for. So I was effectively just accumulating things. And I'm in IT, right? So I'm very familiar with IT-related topics, including cryptocurrencies. So that's really when I first started, I wouldn't say investing, because that was not an investment. I didn't see it as an investment at the time.
Yeah.
But it did help me a lot into understanding exactly how stock markets and commodities markets work from a mechanical sense.
Yeah.
Right. A lot of people have this idea that, oh, there's the price and that price is set for magical reasons and that's what you have to pay. But it was really in 2017 when I started trading small amounts of cryptocurrency that I really began to understand the mechanics of, okay, it's not actually, there isn't actually a price.
Yeah.
There's an order book and it's the order book that you're actually trading against. And that's how things are set. And so I did that in 2017. And it was just a small amount. like I said, 99% of my portfolio, if you could call it that, was purely just cash in my bank account. But it gave me the confidence, and I finally started understanding, okay, I need to look into fees. I need to figure out exactly what the hell I'm doing and how this properly works. And that's when I started paying attention to it and started thinking about my retirement. And that's something that brings me up to a different topic, which was the work that I was doing in Germany. So I was working for a US business that had an office here in Germany, and they offered, as part of their compensation package, a pension plan.
Yeah.
And that's something that's fairly common in a lot of businesses, not just in Germany, but in other companies and other countries. And at the time, I hadn't when I first signed the contract, I was like, oh, okay, this is a nice bonus, right? It's going to be a supplement to my state pension, and hopefully everything will be fine. And I won't have to worry about growing old and retiring, because I'll have this and I'll have the state pension, and that'll be more than enough for my needs. And then in 2019, I was laid off from that company and I found a different job. And the new job did not have such a pension plan. And so it was time for me to either transfer my existing one to the new company or just liquidate it. And when I liquidated it, I started looking into what exactly it actually meant and what exactly they were doing with the money that I was paying them, because I was paying them almost 500 euros a month pre-tax for that pension plan. And I was, let's put it, very disappointed, because once again, there were very high fees, there were very low returns, and it was a matter of, if I had kept paying into that pension plan every month, by the time I got to retire, in the best case scenario, I would receive about half of the cash that I would have put in.
Wow, that's a big
and
drop.
That's before inflation.
Yeah.
So I knew then and there, okay, I need to take my retirement plans into my own hands. I need to invest properly. I need to look and make sure that I'm not paying too many fees. And so let's do this. And so that's when I first opened a DEGIRO account in, I think, September or October of 2019. And yeah, I went in, and at the time I was still very much in the, okay, let's do 60% stocks, 40% bonds. And so I put it into a Vanguard ETF, well, two Vanguard ETFs. One was VUTY. That's a US Treasury bond ETF that pays monthly dividends. And that's really what brought me into the dividend into the dividend community, shall we say. And then the other one was VUSA, which was just a S&P 500 ETF. And I started looking into it, and I liked the dividends. I liked the cash flow. I liked every month putting in a little bit of money and seeing, okay, this is what my portfolio looks like. And that's when I started, okay, I've been doing this for a few months now. I've seen things, and so I've seen a lot of people talk about so and so business, like Realty Income for the monthly dividends, and I decided I'm gonna put a little bit of money on that company just so I can get some dividends be invested into it, you know, more of an entertainment type deal. Because the bulk of my money at the time was still going into index funds. So if I were to put, I don't know, 5-10% of what I put in monthly into a single company, I didn't think that was a big deal. And so the first company that I bought, you may recognize the name, was HSBC.
Yes, a good bank.
Yes, a very good bank, shall we say. And I purchased it in January 1st, 2020. And immediately afterwards, I purchased AT&T just after their dividend, because I misread the ex-dividend date.
Happens to us all. I think we all get caught in that one.
And I also purchased BP. These three companies in my whole history of investment have been the worst investments that I have ever made, ever.
I can see why. Maybe BP, if you held on long enough, you might start to recover now. But certainly there was no recovering at that time from AT&T. It must have been around $35 at that stage, was it?
I think my first purchase was around $38.
Yeah.
It was stupid. Let's be frank. I wasn't investing.
But was that so? Like, a lot of your story so far is resonating with me, because it's quite similar to I started. I remember 2017. We had the great bull run in cryptocurrency. I'm sure you probably had some Ripple. I think everybody had Ripple or XRP at that point. It was one of the major staples, and then moved on to other forms of investing. But at the beginning, you start to get some dividends coming in. You think, hey, I like this. It's quite easy, isn't it, to get trapped into that high yield. And AT&T was just typical of that. They haven't cut their dividend in 40, 50 years. They have a 7% yield. It's so easy to get caught in that.
Exactly right. And HSBC in particular was a case of chasing yield.
Yeah.
Because HSBC, at least up until 2020, had a history of special dividends in the first quarter. And so I bought it in mind with the special dividend. And I held it on the ex-dividend date, and it showed up on my DEGIRO account that it was incoming, but they never paid it because of the pandemic and the restrictions that they were put in.
Yeah.
So that, like I said, I was not investing. I was looking at the companies at a very surface level. I was seeing, oh yeah, they're making some money. They're big companies. Everyone knows them. They look kind of cheap, even though I didn't really know what cheap or expensive was.
Yeah,
they're paying a decently high dividend, and they haven't cut it in a while, so it's probably fine. And it wasn't. And that's part of the reason why I actually started writing my blog, because I saw the mistakes that I made, and I saw that part of those mistakes was because I was only looking at things at a very surface level, right? And I noticed then, and I noticed now, that a lot of content creators also only look at things on a very surface level. There's a lot of people who, and I'm sorry to say this, but whose extent of research is taking a look at a couple of news headlines, seeing, oh, this company is going to take advantage of this macro trend, whatever, and so it's going to be big. So let's buy it.
Yeah.
And that's not a good way of investing. And that's why I started writing my blog. And in fact, if you have a look at the first blog post that I wrote about it,
I remember.
It's exactly about that sort of thing. So, yeah, in 2020, I consider it a learning period. I heavily underperformed the market, partly for structural reasons. So in 2020, I'm not sure if you remember, but the euro gained quite a lot of value against the dollar. And so my companies were denominated in US dollars. And so I got hit by that. And I also had some very bad companies. But I consider that a learning period. I started looking into, okay, how do I value this company? How do I take a look at this? And a lot of this was quite difficult to figure out because a lot of people say, oh, the value of a business is the total cash flows that it's going to output discounted to their present value. And yeah, I had a mathematical education. I mean, my university degree is it's very useful to this sort of thing. So I knew exactly what they meant and how they were doing it, but I wasn't really convinced. And in a lot of ways, I'm still not too convinced about a lot of the valuation techniques that people and investors and institutions use, because a lot of it is just crap. I mean, let's face it, a lot of discounted cash flow analysis and valuations that you can do is essentially pick a price that you want and I'll fiddle with the inputs and the assumptions until we get that price.
Yeah, I agree. And it's something I've struggled with. I started like everyone else. You start with PE ratios, don't you? You work up your dividend discount models, discount cash flows, and you get progressively more. But what I found is that they relied too heavily on me making a lot of assumptions. And I did not trust myself with these assumptions, because usually I'm already after researching or doing enough to know that I like the company. And you're always, even subconsciously, always picking values. Okay, what's the growth rate? Oh, I think they're going to be good. I think they're going to be strong. We don't know. So I do struggle with valuation. It's something that I don't publicize a whole lot anymore, because I realize I'm totally useless at it.
Yeah. I definitely agree. And in terms of, this is particularly relevant to discount models, discounted cash flow models in particular. I mean, a lot of those valuation methods intrinsically assume that the only way to grow a business is to add more capital to it, right? If you have a look at how a discounted cash flow model works, at its core basis is this amount of cash is going to be reinvested back into the business, and that's going to provide a certain return. But there are a lot of businesses where that's just not the case. I mean, what Warren Buffett talks a lot about See's Candy, right? He talks a lot about how if we could invest another $200 million into this business to get the cash flows out of it, we would do it in a heartbeat, but we can't because it's not scalable.
Yeah.
And it's the exact same thing, but discounted cash flow models don't take this into account. So this sort of thing, alongside with a lot of things that investors do, which is unquantifiables, right? A lot of people, and this is actually a discussion that I had with a colleague a couple weeks ago. So for listeners who don't know, I work for a publicly traded company. So you could technically speaking buy shares in that company and become my boss if you want to. But we were talking about the company because they have an employee stock purchase program.
Yeah.
And we were thinking about, is it worth investing? Is it not worth investing? That sort of thing. And my colleague was talking about this initiative that he thought, oh, this is going to be great, right? I'm going to buy shares in the company because this initiative is going to go well, and it's going to make a lot of money. But if you really dig deep into it, what does that actually mean? Right? How much money are we talking about? Is this initiative that's part of this small part of this huge company really going to move the needle? And is that needle moving actually going to impact the stock price enough to justify a potential overvaluation? So it's important for me, for investors, to look deeply into a business and actually quantify the impact that these things are going to have. And you have to be realistic about it. Yeah. I mean, if you have a company that's making $1 million in revenue a year, and you double that to 2 million, but you have a market cap with 500 million, that's really not that great. I mean, it might be a good product.
Yeah.
But for an investor, that's not going to be a good deal. So you have to be aware of vagueness. You have to be able to actually do the math and quantify what's the benefit that this will give to the company and how will that affect the valuation of it. And you have to be aware that these things don't happen overnight, right? It's going to take years, even for companies that are glaringly undervalued. It will take years before that undervaluation can reflect on the share price, if it will reflect at all, right? A lot of the businesses that we have, they may have great they may have great prospects, but I'm not sure if you believe in the efficient market theory, but I don't think the strong efficient market theory will ever hold true. Right?
Yeah.
It's going to take years, and some of them perhaps will never give the return that you want from a market price perspective. And so that's why it's important to have dividends. Because dividends, and particularly growing dividends, they're cash in your pocket.
Yeah.
They're things that you will receive as long as the business is doing well, no matter if everyone else thinks, oh, I hate this business, I don't like it, it's tobacco, right? They're making guns or selling guns, they're polluting the environment or whatever. At the end of the day, if ExxonMobil or Altria or British American Tobacco or something else is disliked by investors and no one wants to own it, I'd buy that in a heartbeat. Any of those companies, if I could buy them for $100 each, I would buy them today and keep operating them as a cash machine for the rest of time.
Yeah. So I hear what you're saying, and I agree with a lot of it. And I do also have to say, in terms of, you spoke initially about investors or content creators in particular not giving enough detail. I think anyone that reads your blog can never accuse you of that. I think the first article you wrote was Affleck, if I remember, or was it 3M, and it was three blog posts long. It was enormous. So you go really, really in depth into companies, which is great. On a high level, what do you look for? What do you initially look for in investments?
So first things first, the company has to be profitable. If a company cannot reliably sustain profits, I'm very sorry, it may have some very bright prospects, but I don't want to own it. That's the way I see it. That's the number one error that a lot of retail investors do. They purchase companies that are unprofitable, and that if things continue as they have been doing so far, they will go bankrupt at some point. So they have to be profitable and consistently so. They have to be at a attractive valuation, although we can go into it later on, because what is an attractive valuation, right?
It's a topic on its own, really, isn't it?
Yeah. And they have to be returning capital to shareholders. I'm not too fussed about doing it via share buybacks or via dividends, although I generally prefer a mixture of the two. But they need to be doing that. And they need to do that consistently. And they need to have a long-standing history of doing that.
Yeah. And what about tax or returning to shareholders? Obviously, if they are buying back shares, there's potentially no tax on that. Is the tax rates quite high? Presumably, you pay in Germany, I think. What's the tax rates like there?
So the tax rate in Germany is about 26.5% for capital gain. Well, not just capital gains, but capital Ertrage. So it's effectively capital winnings, shall we say.
Yes. Yeah.
So dividends and sales both go into that. There is also an 800 euro credit, shall we say. So if you make less than 800 euros, you don't pay that. And if you make more, you basically get to take out 800 euros from your taxable capital Ertrage income. So as to whether or not I consider that in my investment thesis, I have to. I mean, objectively speaking, it impacts the returns that I'm going to have. I'm spending pre-tax money to acquire these sources of income. And so I have to account for the impact that taxes will have on this. Realistically speaking, given the size of my current portfolio, I will end up having to pay some taxes, but it's manageable given my current income to do so without affecting either how much money I put in and without having to take out any to pay for those taxes. But eventually, that will not be the case, right? In a few years, when I am putting in, when my income that I'm getting from dividends and capital gains is on par or higher than my regular work income, that's not really going to be possible, and that's going to affect even further. So I hope that by that time there will be some sort of tax sheltered account here, either here in Germany, or that I will move somewhere where that is the case. So let's cross our fingers for that. But
do you think it's quite probable that there won't be a tax sheltered account, but do you think you may alter your strategy then? Do you think you might work towards something like that, particularly as you start, this snowball effect will start kicking in soon? And
no, because the reason that I have a strategy for this is the fact is I'm trying to maximize my income right now.
Yeah,
effectively. So altering my strategy, what would I alter it to? That doesn't make much sense. That said, I do take some measures to be more tax efficient. So if you follow my blog, you will know that about half of my portfolio is in accumulating index funds.
Yeah,
those have a slightly more favorable tax treatment, and so I would expect, and I'm trying right now to bump that up to a slightly higher amount. So effectively, what I would be doing is constraining my individual plays to a smaller and smaller percentage of my portfolio and just going with the good old Boglehead philosophy of just index fund and chill, so shall we say.
That could be a new hashtag, index fund and chill. I like it.
Yes. So, yeah. But If that is not the case, that ends up not being the case, then at some point I would expect that I will be working primarily to afford the taxes.
Yeah. No, it's quite an interesting story all around. As I said, a lot of parallels with how I started and how I think and feel about investing now. It's always a journey. Keep learning. But I'd like to finish on one question, and I think it's quite important you learn from your mistakes, and it's something that I do as well. For anyone that's starting now, what's the one piece of advice, just one piece of advice you would give them right off the bat?
Watch your fees. Whatever you do, whether you're speculating in cryptocurrency, whether you're speculating on meme stocks, whether you are a long-term dividend investor, the first thing that you need to look out for is the costs that come with investing. And you need to do the math there. You need to have a look at what exactly you are paying in order to invest. And so watch your fees. Make sure that they are as low as you can reasonably get them. And if you are investing in funds or with brokers that charge you fees that are greater than 0.5% of your portfolio, of your transaction, you need to seriously consider leaving. Because there are low-cost brokers here. They have good UIs, they do a good service, and they do so for significantly lower prices than you would think.
Yeah, I think that's important, not even just for investing, but in and around pensions. I know you mentioned pensions earlier. I think it's important that people look into fees, because you'll be surprised. As much as compounding works for you, it also works against you in terms of fees, so it can have a massive impact on returns. So, no, good advice. Thank you. It was an interesting story. I said a lot of parallels with myself, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners will resonate with that. I highly recommend checking out Tiago's blog. It said it's really, really analytical, in depth. He doesn't just gloss over all the trills and frills of a company, digs really deep into them. And exposes a lot of detail. So I highly recommend checking that out, and I'll put a link in the description below. But now we might jump on to some listeners' questions, if that's okay with you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Perfect. So the first one is from Nighthawk, and he's complimenting you on your work and thanking you for your work. But he's asking, why don't you generate a little extra income via Seeking Alpha, like a side hustle for all the world?
So, Derek, you should know about this.
Yeah, I do. I don't write on Seeking Alpha. Time-wise, I think my blog is even to start to slow down, but I do write for Sure Dividend, which I've said before, and Tiago has now joined part of that team as well. So I think we have a side hustle there and a lot of articles to write, and can take up a bit of time. So fitting in Seeking Alpha on top of everything else just would not be possible. And plus, Seeking Alpha, you open yourself up, don't you? Everybody seems to write some nasty comments for no particular reason. So.
I actually like Seeking Alpha. I had a look at some of the, let's be honest, a lot of it is just box spam.
Yeah.
But there are some very good posts, either from CEOs of certain companies or from certain analysts. And I've compared some of the posts there that I've read with some actual equity analysis documents that I got from big investment institutions, banks, investment firms, hedge funds, etc. And I was very disappointed with the hedge funds, put it this way. and surprisingly positive about some of those Seeking Alpha articles. Yeah. So there's definitely some gems there, and I wouldn't consider my blog post to be particularly insightful. It's mostly just a retail investor's perspective. I don't have access to a lot of the information that certain funds have, but it's still useful to read. And I think that the short dividend team, they're doing some good work. I like the consistency, the type of business that they do, and yeah, from time to time I like sending in an article or two about them.
Yeah, for them. Yeah. I think Ben has done an incredible job with them, and he's I know if you've dealt with him in any way, he's a really nice guy, really humble, and they are an absolute pleasure to work for and work with. So I enjoy it. That's why I do it. Seeking Alpha. Although I agree, there is lots of great content out there. I prefer just to stay away. But I think one of the reasons you will see better quality articles maybe from Seeking Alpha over hedge fund investors is retail investors, they were out of passion, don't they? They don't have to do it. When you're a hedge fund manager, it's your job, it's your work, it's mundane, and complacency can set in. And when you're doing it for yourself, maybe you want to go that extra mile. That's just my thoughts.
I think that there's something to that. And another thing is, I think that a lot of fund managers just don't know what they're doing.
Yeah.
I mean, we can have a look at Katie, I forget her last name, from ARK Invest.
Yeah. Kate Holmes, not Kate Holmes, but yes, we know we're talking about Kate. Yeah.
Yeah. So I've seen some of her public articles, and let's be honest, that's something that a high schooler would write. There are very little numbers. There's very little actual insight there. And for funds of her size, they have access to resources that a lot of retail investors simply cannot have. I mean, if I had a fund of her size, I would be doing things like getting satellite footage to count the number of trucks and where they were coming from that entered every single Intel factory, just so I could get a proper estimate of what the production is and the inventory.
Yeah.
I'm a retail investor.
You can't do that.
I don't have the funds to do that. And even if I did, I mean, my position in Intel is so small that whatever alpha that I could get would be massively overtaken by the cost of that research.
We talked about fees, and maybe this is one fee that's quite high.
Exactly. But if you're running, if you're making 200 million a year on fees, you can afford that sort of data, and you can do a lot more than that crappy blog post that they put every once in a while that just takes current price of Tesla and then adds 20% to it.
Exactly. Okay, European DJI has asked us a question from his vacation. And he's asking about our thoughts, and I think I've spoke about this before, so I'll ask you, but your thoughts on his top 10 and what would you change? And don't go easy on him.
Okay, so the good things first. I like a lot of the companies that he owns there. I think they're high quality companies. I don't know if he purchased them at attractive prices, but from what I recall from previous podcast episodes and other things he mentioned, I think a lot of the companies that he did buy, he bought at fairly attractive valuations, like Microsoft or Apple, etc. There are a few companies there that I don't really like, that I think are bad moves. And We've actually had this discussion in the group before, I believe. But there are two companies, well, yeah, two companies there in his top 12, let's put it, that I think probably shouldn't be there just on the grounds of quality. Not even looking at valuation, but just purely on the grounds of what you actually own. Those are not good businesses to own. And one of those is one of his favorites, Ahold Delhaize. And we've had this discussion before. For listeners who aren't familiar with the company, Ahold Delhaize is a Dutch supermarket chain slash retailer. They have also some internet companies like bol.com, but they are primarily a supermarket retailer. And this is a highly competitive business with very, very thin margins, around 2, 3, sometimes if it's a very good business, 4%. And it's just not worth owning because the margins are just too thin.
Just based on the margins.
Exactly. This is the type of business where one new entrant into the market will turn a profit into a loss. This is the type of business where if you get a little bit more inflation, if you have some sort of supply chain issues, if you just fall behind in being able to efficiently source your goods or just marketing in general, you're going to go into a loss. And it's going to be very difficult to bring back. And due to the nature of the business, it's very difficult to actually grow this industry. I mean, effectively everyone already has access to a supermarket. Whatever growth that Ahold Delhaize will gain will be effectively a zero-sum game. They have to take it from someone else. And that's difficult. And in order to do that, you need to compete on price. And you can see that by the margins. So that's one of the businesses that I don't like.
What's the second one?
We've talked about this before. I actually wrote an article about for European Investors Network. That website that we started along with a few other people a few months ago. I need to write more for that actually. But that's Alibaba. And to listeners here and to Alibaba investors, let's be honest, let's be realistic here. The company is worth zero. In the best case scenario, it's worth zero. Whatever value it may have is purely speculative because, on a fundamental level, what Baba or the 9988 Hong Kong shares represent is ownership in a Cayman Islands entity whose sole asset is effectively a bond with no coupon on it.
I think it's a must read for anyone invested or thinking about investing in Alibaba, even just to get a different perspective. And I thought you were going to say Alibaba. I wasn't sure if you're going to pick a dividend stock or not. To European DJI's credit, I think that's a small part of his growth fund that he says, whereas Ahold would be quite a bigger position for him. So a lot of people will hear us talk about Ahold on this, but I think it's refreshing for someone to come on and challenge and give a different perspective, because everyone has a different opinion, and I think it's important to hear from both sides, not just the glossy cherry on top. You need to hear both sides. So You make some valid points, and I know you've already spoke to each other about this before, so it's not going to be surprising. I don't think it's going to be too surprising, but no, very good. We got a question from Doris Ant, I think he's called, and he said the market is already lower, but may well continue to decline. This can go rapidly or slowly. If you are dollar cost averaging every month, what would be your strategy?
Sure. So I am dollar cost averaging every month. Every month I put in a certain, it's not really a fixed amount of my income because it depends on whether I have big expenses or not. Every month I make a small budget, figure out, okay, what am I going to spend next month? But it's usually a fairly consistent amount. And I generally do not invest based on market conditions. But what I have done before is if there are certain specific deals in, and this has happened somewhat recently with Footwalker, where a company is just glaringly undervalued, and I can tell that it's going to be something very temporary, I may be willing to dip a little bit into margin to go into that and then pay that margin off over time. Additionally, like I mentioned, I do a budget every month. Yeah. I think that's something that everyone should do. And if you're not doing one, you should do one. It doesn't take long, 5 minutes. And I always assign a small amount of money to miscellaneous things. So stuff like, oh, I might want to go to the movie, or I might want to go to a restaurant. Things that I don't necessarily know that I'm going to do throughout the month, but I would like to have the ability to do so. And oftentimes I don't use that money. So it's just set aside into a small part of my bank account. And if the market went particularly low, I might be willing to take out that money and just add it in. And of course, whenever I get any bonus or some other money from elsewhere, I just add it in as well. And I'm guessing you do something similar as well, right? With a monthly investment schedule.
Yeah, pretty much similar. So, I mean, have a house with two kids, so it's not always possible to put the same amount in, although I do try to be consistent. When I budget on the lower end, so I can always put in the same amount, and anything else over, I can certainly put into it. But what I did find interesting was your thoughts around investing with margin, which is something not too many people do. Is there fees on that? If you dip into that margin, is there fees on that?
So margin is effectively a loan, right? So there's interest on it. I use Interactive Brokers. So right now the interest on it is fairly low. It's about less than 2%. It's about 1.5%. And when I say that I dip into margin, I don't mean that I go balls deep.
Yeah,
30% of my portfolio is now margin. It's more of a, okay, I might be willing to go 1 or 2% of my portfolio into margin, and I have more than enough money in my bank account to, if I wanted to or if I needed to, I could just transfer it over and boom. It's just that money that's allocated to other non-essential expenses, or that I just like to keep on the side in case of anything coming up, that I prefer keeping it in my bank account and dipping a little bit into margin than to putting it into my portfolio, because I know if I put it into my portfolio, I'm not going to take it back out. So yeah.
Yeah, awesome. We got a question from Vad India, and she would love to hear your thoughts again on AFLIC and discuss what you think. Is it still a solid buy at current levels? I think you wrote a blog post about your thesis, or you revisited that thesis recently.
That's right. So I wrote a blog post going back to AFAC, seeing if the thesis has held up, if everything has gone on as expected, if the company is still fairly valued or not. And actually, just earlier this week, I was going through the numbers again and doing some valuations and fiddling a little bit with the assumptions just to see if anything big changed. And effectively speaking, I still believe that the company is undervalued. I think that it's a decent, high-quality company that does a business that I understand and does so in a profitable manner. So I have no problems remaining invested in AFAC. I've actually, just a couple of weeks ago, I believe, purchased some additional shares there. So it was already my biggest position and I added to it. And I think it's at a good price right now. But again, please keep in mind, this is my view on it, right? I make my evaluation methods public. I write about it. But at the end of the day, this is purely my view on it. And I may be wrong. Or even if I'm right, it may be that you have a different time horizon or investment prospect. And so you should do your own research. Before you buy any company, whatever it may be, you should always, at the very least, read their latest annual report, understand the business, take a look at their track history of over the past 10, 20 years, make sure that it's a profitable business that isn't going to go bankrupt anytime soon, that doesn't have gigantic amounts of debt. And if you like what you see and you understand the business and your valuations say that it's worth more than what it's trading at, then it might be worth considering buying. But again, this is an individual thing, and I'm not managing anyone else's money other than my own. So if I screw up, I'm the only one who gets harmed. Yeah. And you should take that.
I think that goes without saying. We say that quite a bit on here. We don't give advice. We give you our thoughts, but it's not necessarily correct or right. So yes, I agree with you. We got a question then about our thoughts on the Admiral Group. I know they're an insurance company in the UK, but I honestly don't know much more than that. So I don't have too much to say about them.
So I too don't know much about them. The first time that I heard about it was with this question. From what I understand, it's an insurance business based in the UK that does primarily car insurance. Mm-hmm. But I can't give you any particular details there. I don't think that it's the type of business that I would be interested in owning, purely on the matter of I already have an insurance business right now. It's already a big part of my portfolio. And I don't think that I need a second one at the moment.
Yeah. Just looking at the dividend yield, it's nearly 6%, which is quite high. It seems a lot of these small to mid-cap UK insurance companies have high yield. I know Chesnara is another company that European DGI has. So it's probably of a similar vein of that. But again, instead, I don't know too much more other than to say that maybe European DGI, we might ask him that question. I know he's done a lot more research on
it may be a good business to own. I mean, realistically speaking, for retail, for small investors, these small and mid-cap companies can definitely be a make or break type of business. But you have to be very careful about what you're doing, and you have to understand the business at a deep level. And I don't understand that business, and right now it doesn't fit into my strategy, so I won't be investing in it.
it's quite interesting. They've been declining in share price since August 2021, and they're down now around 2019 levels. So there's a reason for that. I don't know why, but there's obviously something behind that. We got a question then about who would we prefer, Home Depot or Lowe's, based on current valuation.
This is a similar answer to the Admiral Group. I haven't really looked into either of these. Both of them, I did look at the price, I did look at the earnings, but I saw the PE ratio on both of them and immediately I was not interested.
Yeah, I think there was 17 and 20 are in around those areas, I think.
Yes, so they seem pricey, but it may be worthwhile, it may not, but at least so far I'm not interested. No. And so I haven't looked into them.
So we did get one question on email, which is not in front of you, but it's around Coca-Cola. What do you think of them now? Do you think they're back on that growth trend, or is it still too early to say?
I think that if you are investing in Coca-Cola for growth, you're probably investing in the wrong company. This is not to mean that they can't increase revenues or that they can't increase profits above market rate, but I think that there is a very limited possibility for Coca-Cola to actually grow how much cans of Coke they sell.
Yeah.
Everyone knows Coca-Cola. Everyone who would like to get some Coca-Cola is able to get some Coca-Cola. And so there's just not that much space for growth. That being said, there are significant opportunities with Coca-Cola.
Coffee is one, for example. That's
right. So they have been expanding into other drinking products, and they've done so in a very successful way, and they have been making their operations significantly more efficient over the past 5-6 years. And so I think the company has good prospects. I don't think they're going to go bankrupt anytime soon. So it's just a matter of, does this company trade at an attractive valuation? I looked into this a year ago when I was initially refreshing my portfolio in early 2021, because I used to be a Coca-Cola shareholder. I used to own some shares of Coca-Cola purchased during the 2020 dip, shall we say?
Yep.
And I looked into it and I ended up deciding to go with Pepsi, because in terms of valuation, they were both fairly in line with each other. And it was basically a coin flip. And then I eventually sold Pepsi because I believed and I still believe that it's overvalued. And I expect that Coca-Cola is going to be in a similar situation. And I think that if investors like you who are looking at it from a growth perspective, will probably be disappointed if that growth does not materialize. And so whatever investment that I might make into Coca-Cola again, which I'm not ruling out, to be clear, will have to be from a perspective of right now, given the current revenue and earnings, and without any significant growth in the future, this company is worth the price that I'm paying for it.
Yeah. I mean, they have had some significant growth since 2010. I think the share price is 2x, and then reinvesting of dividends on top of that is obviously quite handsome. But I think I wrote an article which Eli Snowball disagreed with me about their prospects. I do like what they did with their operations, and they made it a little bit more leaner. And I think my point at the time was that I wanted to see how that was going to play out, how that goes. I have TradingView in front of me, and I drew where I sold it. I have a line and I have a price, and I said it's not going to go too far within that range. It is $1.50 outside that range at the minute, but it looks like it's coming back down. So it's not too far away, and that's in the last year, just over a year since I sold it. So it hasn't gone really anywhere. I haven't missed out. I still think it's too early to say. I think there's lots of potential. There's coffee. They could also pivot and do stuff like Pepsi can do. They went to more healthy options, which I think they need to do, to be honest with you, because we do know more health conscious people are starting to come away from sugar. So there's that side of it. But I'm like you, for growth and pure growth, I don't see it. I think there's huge potential, but I would need to see them down around $30 before I would even be interested.
Yeah. I'm not sure about the exact number. Last time I did evaluation, it gave me around 25-ish or so. But again, it's a quality company. It has some bright prospects. It's just expensive right now.
Yeah. And we did get a question on the show about Snap-on there a couple of weeks ago. I don't know if you remember. Are you aware? Do you know anything about the company?
Snap-on?
Yeah. So when it was mentioned originally, I'd never heard of the company, European DJI. I didn't hear of the company, and we made a funny joke about it and kind of dismissed it as a fancy growth stock. In that same email, I won't mention the name because I didn't ask permission. I don't know if he wants me to say the name, but I was encouraged to look a little bit deeper into the company, and I was actually quite surprised by this. They have a really good, really, really good dividend history. I think they haven't cut the dividend in 33 years. It was flat in 2009 for the 2 years, like most other companies.
What does this company do exactly?
It's like Stanley Black & Decker in that same old industrial that sells power tools, hand tools, and that kind of area. So it's in the similar mold as Stanley Black & Decker, which is quite interesting. For me, it's a good business model. I mean, but it's highly competitive. That's my one thing. You got Stanley Black & Decker. You got a couple of Japanese companies around are making hand tools. But when we run this through our screener, so I was asked to run it through my screener. I get a 5-year dividend growth rate of 17.46%. I was not expecting that. Chowder rule is 20.5. EPS payout ratio 35%. Free cash flow payout ratio 39%. Revenue growth over the last 5 years of 19%. Free cash flow growth of 12%, and earnings per share growth of 12%. And they've got, and this is what I was not expecting, they got zero debt to equity. They've got no long term debt on their balance sheets.
Really?
None. Yes. So I was.
Have they been diluting shareholders, perhaps?
I don't think so. Not that it did not stick out to me that they have been. But let me quickly check that.
What's their dividend history?
The dividend history is impressive. It's, as I said, it's uncut in 33 years, and it was flat in 2009. So we have a 33, 34 year history in it. So it's definitely a company that has now got my attention. I just ran them basically through my screeners. I did not do any deep, as I said, deep research into them, just basic filters. Is revenue grown? Gross margins are steady at around 51%. Net income is growing. Shares, they're not diluting shares. In fact, they're buying back shares quite heavily, which is good to see. Free cash flow is growing. Dividends growing. So it certainly ticks all the right boxes at the moment. So I do apologize to our listeners. We fob these off, but they are now added to our fundamental analysis data set, and they will have my attention going forward.
Yeah. Sounds like an interesting business. I'll have to look into it myself.
Yeah. And the ticker is SNA for those. So that's the last of the questions. I have one more question for you. And it is your, we know you like AFRIC, but maybe your favorite stock of the week. It's not a recommendation, but if you were to choose one stock other than AFRIC.
Of the week?
Yeah.
Or,
Or it can be any time frame.
Difficult to say. All right. So I have one. And this is not a recommendation. To be clear, I do not own this company anymore. I do not have any plans to purchase it again anytime soon. But I have a bit of a soft spot for Maine. So that's Main Street Capital, the ticker symbol Maine. For those of you who don't know, this is a business development company. They effectively give loans and support to small businesses, help them grow their business, and then in return they get paid back with the loans or with some percentage ownership of that business. The thing that gives me the sweet spot for this company is this is the first company that I really looked deeply into. It's the first company that I went in, read the last three annual reports. I had a look at their cash flows. I had a look at their balance sheet. I went through a list of the loans and equity interests that they had with other small businesses. I went through the management team. I went through everything that I could think of at the time. And I really liked the business. Not just from a valuation perspective, which at the time this was in 2020, so they were their valuation was very depressed. But from just an operational perspective, the way they did money, the way they worked, everything, it was a very interesting business to see. And if you are doing some investing, some valuation, I would encourage you, if you're just starting out, I would encourage you to start out by trying to value a business development company like Main Street Capital, although there are others similar to it. Because effectively what you are doing when you're valuing that business is seeing how those businesses value other businesses. And it's a bit meta, but it gives you a very interesting insight on how it works. And it's not as complicated as some other businesses because it's all written down in the annual report. They go through how they value it. They go through everything. So go through it. Take a look at the annual reports. Value it. It's an interesting business. I like Main Street Capital. And if it comes back down, I might look back into buying back in. But we'll see.
It's something different. So that's the end of the show. That was awesome. Thanks a million for coming on and joining me today in European DJ's absence. It's been a pleasure. As I said, the story resonates with me. And thanks again to all our listeners as well for all the questions. I hope you enjoyed it, Tiago.
Yeah, I did. Glad to be here. And for the listeners, if you would like to look into my writings, the companies that I value, etc. Feel free to check out my blog. You'll find a link in the description, or you can just find me on Twitter. I usually tweet not that often, maybe once or twice a week. But if you're interested in a weekly newsletter, check it out.
Yeah, and I will reiterate that I highly recommend it. So as always, thanks to our listeners, and we'll see you all next week.
Thank you. Cheers.